One little tiny little rabbit turn out here, that the very first book written in the Bible and the very last book, covering the very end of all things, say two things. It says one thing about Satan at the beginning and at the end of time, and it says that Satan is constantly accusing God's people before God, day and night. Job tells us in chapter 1 and Revelation tells us that. That's his deal. So while he's standing there doing his litany of, you know that person over there you think is, you know, so hot to serve you, well, let me tell you what I know about them, let me tell you the dirt on them, and in fact I have videos I can show you, and he's doing his whole accusation thing. And right in the middle of that, God says, well, have you checked out my servant Job? I can always see God smiling. Because he says, you know, there's not one human like him. Yeah, they all fail. Yeah, he once in a while he falls too, but you know what? He's blameless. Because when he falls, he makes it right with me. He hates evil. He shuns it. He avoids it. He lives with integrity. Nobody like him. Why would God say that if you didn't notice? When you make right choices, does that affect God? It does. It blesses his heart. Does he stop loving you if you make wrong choices? Well, no. His love for you doesn't have anything to do with the choices that you make. But does it affect him when you make wrong choices that hurt you and that hurt others? Yes, it does affect him. So Elihu is out to lunch already, chapter 35. In the next 8 or 9 verses, there are two threads that I picked up in this. And once again, you guys are so brave to even sit through Job because it is cumbersome language. I can't tell you how hard I study to chase down all of the words and try to grab the syntax of it. Commentaries are not really that helpful. I was surprised that I couldn't find very many really helpful commentaries in Psalms either. Job is even worse. But see if you notice two threads of Elihu's train of thought in here. See if you, because he's not really coming right out and saying everything. He indirectly slams Job, but I think there's also a clue in here, because one of Job's biggest complaints has been, I don't know why God's not talking to me. Constantly, all through the whole debate, Job has been crying out. Remember, he'd be answering one of his accusers, and right in the middle of his answer, he would look up to God like Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof, and he would start talking to God, and he said, I don't get it. I don't understand why you're not answering me. So see if you can pick up on what Elihu says about that. Speaking of people who are affected by wickedness, in verse 8, verse 9 says, because of the multitude of oppressors or oppression, people cry out. People cry out for help because of the arm of the mighty. And the implication is, but not to God. But no one says, where is God, my maker, who gives songs in the night? Parenthetically, who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of heaven. Those people cry out, but he doesn't answer because of the pride of evil men. Surely God will not listen to empty talk, nor will the Almighty regard it. That means pay attention to it or honor it. And now he quotes from something Job said back in 23, but once again, he's got the context of it wrong. Although you say that you don't see him, and yet your justice is before him, and you must wait for him. Remember back in chapter 23, Job says, look, I know I can't see him, and I know he's not talking to me, but I know he sees me. He knows all of my way, and I know if I could just stand before him, I would get justice. And when I'm tested, I would come forth as pure gold in this matter. And once again, that's answering the accusations that they were making against him. So he's sort of misquoting that and saying, I know you think that you would have justice if you could just see him and and you're waiting for justice. And that's that part should be in quotations. Elihu says, and now because he has not immediately punished in his anger, nor taken much notice of folly. In other words, up till now, just because you didn't immediately get everything that you deserve, now you're opening your mouth uselessly is a better translation than what my New King James says, vain, in vain. Opening your mouth uselessly, and Job multiplies words. You can almost see him looking around like Perry Mason, looking around at these three guys listening like, you know, Perry Mason looking at the jury. He multiplies words without knowledge. Underline that phrase. Because when God comes on the scene and says his first words, he quotes this phrase, and I believe that he's quoting it against Elihu, not against Job. And I'll tell you why when we look at him. So did you pick up the two threads through that 8 or 9 verses? I'm not the only one that sees these things. It's true, you're just coming off of your day and you didn't spend 10 hours today studying or yesterday or whatever and looking over this. So I realize I have it under a microscope and I'm not expecting everybody to just jump on it. That's why we record things. And you're welcome to check it out. And if you don't come to the same conclusions, that is your business. But I see two things that he's saying. The one is the most obvious, though he's talking about just wicked people. He says, yeah, wicked people cry out. They bellyache all the time. They're always complaining. This is not fair. I don't deserve this. And, you know, just like you have been doing, Job. But, you know, the problem, Job, is you're not really crying out to God, your maker. You're not really praying with humility, Job, or passionately. Isn't that something that so-called spirit-filled people love to say? You're not praying hard enough. You're not passionate enough. I don't know. I've heard that my whole life, growing up around that. The whole problem is you're just not praying enough. Okay, let me ask you a question. You've been here for the whole time. You've looked at so far 35 chapters of this. Has Job been talking to God? Oh, yeah. He hasn't shut up. In fact, Job has maybe the most pure, unselfish prayers of anybody in the whole Bible apart from Jesus. In the very beginning, when Job loses everything, he bows down and he worships. And then when his wife tells him, just curse God and die, because obviously God's not on your side, he says, honey, are we just going to accept good stuff from God and not unpleasant things? Is that the way we're going to treat him? I mean, every time he talks with God, even at the point of lowest despair when he's pushed and goaded by these guys and he feels like he's on trial, he's constantly talking to God. He does say some rash things, which he's also admitted. Remember, he was cornered by one of the guys and he said, look, if you had boils all over your body like I do, look at the pus running down my arm. If you were in my circumstances, you'd say a few rash things too. God isn't going to hold it against me. And God didn't hold it against him. Although it's interesting that in chapter 42, after all of Job's begging to, you know, get God in court and present his case, it's kind of another story when you're actually standing there talking to God. And Job, when he finally meets God, he just says, you know what? I stink. I'm dirt. I'm going to close my mouth. And I'm not even going to attempt to defend myself. I said a lot of stuff I didn't know what I was talking about. So Job does have humility before God where it counts. So I see Elihu saying, you just haven't been really praying hard enough, Job, because if you had been talking to God, you'd be filled with songs of deliverance right now. Have you ever heard that from people? I heard that from a few people when I lost everything. What's wrong with you, Bob? It's been 2 weeks. You should be praising God. Yeah, but my heart just got ripped out without an anesthetic, and I just lost everything. does God expect you to just, you know, be a mouseketeer? Is that the victorious Christian life? Oh, no. That's something, but that's not the victorious Christian life. Find somebody in Scripture. Just look at the most godly people. Read the Psalms. God talks about David, who wrote most of the Psalms, and said, this is a guy after my own heart. And David's a crybaby a lot of the time. He's paranoid. He thinks that his life is about over. Of course, people were trying to kill him. But he's all over the map emotionally. He just always pulled himself out of it, not by being sucking it up and being happy like a mouseketeer, but by remembering who God was, by submitting himself to God's plan, and then God's peace came to him. So this whole thing that Elihu says, you know, I don't hear anybody in humility crying out to God, their maker, because if you did, you'd have those songs in the night. You'd be singing and dancing right now, Job. You wouldn't be moping. Well, it's really easy to say when you're not suffering. And, of course, the other thing is really obvious in verse 12 where he says, well, you say God's not answering, but God doesn't answer people who are wicked because of their pride. So that's Elihu's opinion. Now, what we're going to see over the next two chapters, it starts about the just towards the end of chapter 36, and it goes all the way through chapter 37. Last night when we were talking about this up at in Rockland, somebody, I can't remember who it was, might have been Tony, said, you know, it's like God finally just can't stand it. He's just not going to put up with this anymore. So what he does, the coolest thing. He just moves this enormous, life-threatening storm with a tornado in. And right in the middle of where Elihu is pontificating and, you know, talking about how he's a God spokesman, the storm just gets louder and louder, and pretty soon Elihu's screaming. And the all of chapter 37, he just rambles. He completely loses his train of thought. As the, you know, you can almost see him going, and God makes thunder, and look at that whirlwind. And he finally just totally fizzles out. It's deafening. It's so loud he can't talk. It's so dark with the storm clouds, he can't see the faces of the guys that he's talking to. And then when finally he shuts up, then God speaks. I wanted to tell you a funny story that Max Lucado told in one of his books, and I was so glad I read it. He's a good storyteller, but he talked about when he was a missionary in Brazil, and his mother and a friend came down to visit. And he had been wanting, Brazil's a big country, he had been wanting to show his mom the most important sites in Brazil. One of them is the, you know, two of the largest waterfalls in the world are in Brazil. So one of them, he said he had studied up, he'd read National Geographic articles, he had memorized all kinds of data about the waterfall. And you take the bus and you park at the bottom of the hill, and then you take this windy donkey trail back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth at the top of the ridge. And then when you cross over the top of the ridge, spread out before you like Victoria Falls or Niagara Falls is this huge waterfall. And he said, so he's chatting all the way to the parking lot, and he's telling all these factoids that he'd memorized to his mom. And he said, and as we're walking on the switchbacks up the trail, he said, I noticed I was talking louder and louder and louder and louder. And he says, I was getting very irritated. This is getting hard. And he said, and my mom and her friend were one switchback ahead of me. And he noticed that when they got to the top of the hill, they stopped and they were just standing there and they weren't listening to a word I said. And he thought, I've spent all this time, you know, memorizing all these facts. Well, what was it that drowned out his little speech? Well, it was the waterfall. When all of a sudden there's the waterfall, you know, you don't need any little speeches anymore. There it is. Well, that's a beautiful definition of chapter 36 and 37 of Job. I just find it so cool. Anybody who thinks that God is never sarcastic, the book of Job is filled with sarcasm on God's part. It's quite effective, actually, and it's funny. Makes me, but I just love this. I love this guy who is the spokesman for God. One who is perfect in wisdom is before you now, Elihu says. While he's talking, God just moves in and shuts him up and interrupts him. Elihu proceeded and said, chapter 36, "Bear with me a little, and I will show you that there are yet words to speak on God's behalf. I will fetch my knowledge from afar." You can almost see him glancing toward the heavens as he says, "I will fetch my knowledge from afar." In the Bob movie, that's the way it is. "I will ascribe righteousness to my maker." In an indirect way, that's an insult against Job, because remember, he's accused Job of saying that Job was more righteous than God, and Job never said that. Job constantly ascribed righteousness to God, and that's why it was so baffling, because what happened to Job, if God was punishing him for something he didn't do, that would not be righteous. So he says, I'm going to ascribe righteousness to God. "Truly, my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is now with you." Give me a break. Oh, but see, he's filled with the Spirit. He's gifted. Oh, God. You know, one of the most dangerous things is when you know that God is using you, and then to forget that you can totally flub up in the very next sentence. You can totally flesh out. You can be led by the Spirit 1 minute and then just totally. I mean, Peter teaches us that, and this young man teaches us that, and it's sobering because I have been there. "One who's perfect in knowledge is now with you. Behold, God is mighty, yet despises no one." That's true. In fact, he says a lot of true things in here. He only is false when he talks about why this is happening to Job. But this is a lot of true things. "He is mighty in strength of understanding. He doesn't prolong the life of the wicked, but gives justice to the oppressed." By the way, that is true. God just doesn't always do it immediately. I always think of Egypt, the Israelites in Egypt. And God speaks to Moses, and God sends Moses to him and says, "Tell my people, I have heard your cries for deliverance." And every time I read that, I want to think, which cries would those be in the last 405 years that we've been crying out? I mean, you just now are hearing what is like the mail slow or something? You know, God doesn't think in time in the way we do. We are always desperate. And if God doesn't do it immediately, then we think he's not doing anything, but his timing is perfect. But I just think it's interesting. "He gives justice to the oppressed. He doesn't prolong the life of the wicked." Well, yeah. But not according to sometimes our timetable. And that was part of the problem that Job was having. These guys were saying, "God just cuts wicked people off." And Job says, "Well, show me one. Show me a wicked guy that didn't die of old age with his kids all around him, you know, fat and happy and his dishonestly gained." He says, "That's not what the man in the street says." So your logic, he says to these guys, that doesn't work. The truth is that some wicked people face judgment after they live a long, fulfilled life in their sin. They still face judgment, but you won't see it. And the other fact is that sometimes righteous people suffer temporarily. Verse 7, "God does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous. They are on the throne with kings, for he has seated them forever. They are exalted." Now, that could be a slam against Job, because Job was a ruler in his, a great man in his country, and it could be he's saying, well, You know, you used to think you were important and now you're not. And if you were really a righteous person, you'd still be up there sitting on the throne. I don't know, but I just want to ask you this. Did God take his eyes off Job for 1 second? No. Did it look like God had taken his eyes off Job? See, that's the problem, isn't it? That's the thing you have to keep telling yourself over and over when something horrible happens and it's not going away and it just seems to go on forever and ever. The thing you have to keep telling yourself is, wait a minute. He sees me. He's watching me. He's allowing this. And he's good. And so I'm going to wait on him. And that's precisely what Job was doing. In enormous emotional and physical pain and spiritual confusion, Job did that. And none of these guys who weren't suffering could see that. Verse 8, if they, and that by the rules of syntax, you come to a pronoun, it refers back to the last person who was doing any action. So he's speaking of in verse 7, the righteous people. If righteous people, they are bound in fetters, in other words, like you, if they're held in the cords of affliction, then he tells them their work and their transgressions, that they've acted defiantly. Now, Job doesn't need to hear this. He said this very same thing. He says, look, if God has a beef with me, he's always told me before. It's not like him to just punch me and then not tell me what I did. And of course, Elihu is saying, yeah. God isn't like that. If you're suffering needlessly and you're a righteous person like you claim, God would be telling you what you've done wrong. And he also opens their ear to instruction and commands that they turn from iniquity. Every single one of Job's counselors, including this young, arrogant man, have all told Job that he needs to repent and admit that he's a hypocrite and a sinner. And when he doesn't listen to them, they say, you're not listening to our instruction and we're speaking for God. And I'll tell you, I've been in that loop before. It is the most frustrating thing in the world when someone has decided the kind of a person they think you are. You can't defend yourself. 10 angels could come down and swear on a stack of Bibles in agreement with you, and it wouldn't change some people's mind. How frustrating. No wonder Job wanted to stand before God. Now, speaking of the righteous people who have been afflicted because there's some wrong in their life, and now God has told them, verses 8, 9, and 10, God has told them and opened their ear to instruction. He's told them what they did wrong. Now, the next few things that he says are true. They just don't apply to Job. Verse 11, if they obey and serve him, they shall spend their days in prosperity and their years in pleasures. And I wrote in parentheses, well, just wait a little while, because that's what's going to happen to Job. This isn't the whole rest of his life. But if they don't obey, they shall perish by the sword. And that's a euphemism for sudden cataclysmic death. It doesn't mean a literal sword. It just means when you are out of the blue, somebody comes and cuts off your life, which is essentially what has happened to Job, short of his physical life ending. And they shall die without knowledge. So if you can see the contrast there in those six verses. So you claim to be a righteous person, and this all has come upon you, this affliction, and you don't deserve it. Well, you know what? And you say, God's not telling you what you did wrong. Well, maybe that's not the problem. Maybe the problem is he is telling you, and you're just not listening. If you would just obey, you can have a long, happy life. But you know what? Everything gets cut off eventually to the person that won't obey when they're being reproved by the Lord, and you'll die without ever figuring out what happened. And of course, none of that applies to Job. But the hypocrites in heart store up wrath. They don't cry for his help when he binds them. That's the same line that he said.